Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is Lori Rader Day. Lori is the author of several books, but the one we're going to be highlighting is a book called Under a Dark Sky. It sounds intriguing, and it is when you read it. Lori Rader Day, With Respect. Lori, how are you today?
I'm doing great, John.
Good.
How are you?
I'm alive. I'm healthy. I'm happy. It's the best thing I can, interpret it for you.
It's all you can ask for, right?
That's right. Lori, where are you from originally?
I am from central Indiana originally, about halfway between Indianapolis and West Lafayette, if people are knowledgeable about the area. But I live in Chicago now. I've been in Chicago for about 18 years.
Let me ask you this: on the route, from our Michigan down to Indianapolis, there is a wind farm. It's huge. I don't know if you have seen it, or it's about halfway before you get to Indianapolis, and it seems like thousands of big windmills. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
I am very familiar with that drive.
Oh, yeah?
The drive down 65 from Chicago to Indianapolis. I do it quite often to see my family, and I know what you're talking about. It's popped up right before our eyes. It didn't exist, and all of a sudden it's, hundreds of those windmills, those big industrial windmills.
Well, and one time my law partner and I were driving down to take a statement, to do a deposition down in Indy, and we passed through this on it was a different road. It was not an expressway. It was a two-lane road. And she said, let's stop. And so we did. And it was quiet. It was out in the country. It was quiet, except for this hum of the various windmills. But it was an eerie sound and feeling, and also kind of comforting. I'm not sure what it'd be like to live underneath those guys, but I know there's some people complain about it. But at any rate, it was just an interesting thing about Indiana. I've never seen quite so many of those windmills in one place. At any rate,
that area is it's a really windy spot, so it makes sense that they would set up a wind farm there. I'm not sure. There's not a lot going on town wise in that area, so I'm not sure that many people live close to them. But farmhouses.
So you grew up there in Indiana?
I grew up south of that wind farm. In Boone County, Indiana. So we lived in outside of town, and then we lived in town, and then we lived outside of town again. The house where I lived when I went to high school is out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. It's the nearest neighbor's about a half mile away. The school bus I had to take to school, an hour in the morning, an hour at night.
Wow.
It was it's pretty far out there. Yeah.
Were your family farmers?
No, we lived in a house that was surrounded by fields that other people farmed, but we were never farmers. My parents just really liked being out away from, the city, quote unquote, but they meant Lebanon, Indiana, which is about maybe 20,000 people now. But we lived 4 miles away from the nearest town, which is only about 380 people. And we lived 4 miles away from that town.
All right. Now, I was raised in Chicago and its suburbs, and so we used to come out to Michigan in the weekends and summer vacations, and it was, for me, it was great to get out of the city, but I also know that people who were raised on the farm, some of them say, I will never marry a farmer. I will never live in the country. I want a city. So it goes back and forth.
I think you react to whatever it is you know, and you have to get away. But then once you're away, you realize, oh, I missed some things about, you know, how I used to live in the country where no one was.
Yeah.
I miss the quiet. I'll tell you that. I live in Chicago now. The houses are very close together in the neighborhood. I live in Chicago, but in a bungalow neighborhood, and the houses are close together. And I miss the quiet.
Sure.
I miss the dark, to get to the topic of the book. You know, out in the middle of nowhere in Colfax, Indiana, or outside of Colfax, Indiana, or Thorntown, Indiana, you can see the stars. In Chicago, not so much.
Not so much. Before we get into your book, tell me about your parents. What did they do for a living, or what?
Well, my mom and my stepfather live in Lebanon, Indiana, and he works in a factory as a welder. My dad just passed away 2 months ago. He was a truck driver. He used to drive aviation fuel and jet gas for AvFuel. It's a company in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And my stepmother, who still lives out in the middle of nowhere in, near Thorntown, Indiana, works in a hospital. She's in the kitchen, you know, doing the dietary needs of the patients, as well as running the cafeteria for visitors.
Well, when you were living in that house way out in the middle of nowhere, and you had to take an hour back and forth from school, what is it that you really liked? What did you want to do? What were your fun things?
Well, I was always a big reader. That was always important to me. My parents used to take us to the library every week. When we lived in town, we'd walk there. And it was just, you know, that was just something that I loved to do. My sister wasn't as much into reading as I was, but I loved it. I just loved, you know, tucking in somewhere with a book. So, you know, actually on the school bus, it wasn't that hard to spend the time, because I could read on the school bus, or I could do my homework, or I could take a nap. When you've got an hour to kill, you can do a lot of things, actually. But I love to write stories. I used to draw a lot, too. That was something that I did early on that I don't do anymore. But I used to be, like, you know, the kid in the family or the kid in my class who was the artist.
You know, I've had a number of authors as guests on my show, and they all have a different reason for or background to why they became a writer. Each one is just a little bit different, or maybe a lot different. What about you? You said that you like to read and write, but did you ever think that this was going to be a career for you?
I didn't even know really that writing could be a career. I think pretty early on, I mean, I realized when I was 6 or 7 years old, these books that I loved, they were created by somebody. I remember that exact moment when I realized there was a name on the front cover of this book that I loved so much, a book about a girl named Ramona Quimby. There was a name on the cover that wasn't Ramona Quimby. It was Beverly Cleary. And, you know, at 6 or 7, I'm wondering, who is this person and why is she on this book? Either my teacher or my librarian, or I figured out for myself, this is the person who's creating these stories that I enjoy so much. There are people who create stories. Maybe I could be one of those people. And so that's my first creative act. I tried to write a Ramona Quimby story, something that we call fan fiction now. It's kind of an industry, but I think at the time, you know, I wouldn't have known anything about that, and I don't know that fan fiction really existed the way it does now. So it was really kind of a act of theft, you know, stealing somebody else's character and starting to write a story about her. That was my first moment of being a writer. Thinking it could be a life's work or a career, I don't think that I ever thought it could be me. Maybe I knew that there were people who did that, but I don't think I knew it could be me until very, very late in this process, not until I was probably 2016. I mean, not 2006. A friend of mine from high school published a book. Somebody that I had known in high school, somebody that I had beaten in a writing competition in high school, published a book. And not until that moment did I realize, oh, someone from the middle of nowhere like me might be able to do this if not for a living, at least, you know, do it as a sideline. Yeah, I went to school to be a journalist. You know, that's the working man's version of being a writer, is that you find, you know, what is the job that you can have. Being a novelist was not a job that I could consider. I was from a working class background, and I was the first person in my family to go to college. So it needed to be, you know, something that was direct, and this is the kind of job I can get when I get out of here. I never was a journalist, by the way. I have 2 journalism degrees, and I never, not once, worked as what I would call an actual journalist. But I did get very good training at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Both of those degrees are from there. And I worked in public relations for most of my 20-year career.
Whereabouts in, was it in Chicago that you were in public relations or someplace else?
Well, I started working in Indiana after I graduated the first time. I worked in advertising for a year in Indianapolis. And then I got a job offer from Ball State University. And it was just everything I had gone to school to do, all of it, in one job. And so it was too good of an opportunity to pass up. So I went back to Muncie. None of my friends were there anymore because they had all, you know, graduated and moved on. But it was just a great job. And so I worked for the university for about 5.5 years, taught there just on the side, and then finished up that second journalism degree. You know, that first journalism degree wasn't enough. I had to get a second one to not do journalism. And then when I moved to Chicago, I worked in healthcare communications. All of it, not-for-profit communications, really was the focus, and then I worked for another university here in the area.
Well, now I think everybody knows. If they don't, we're going to tell them now for the first time. Writing as a novelist or a historian or whatever, having a cookbook, whatever, is not a lark. It can be a lot of fun, but it's hard, isn't it?
I don't know about cookbooks. I imagine they're very hard in a different way. Yeah, I think any creative endeavor that, you know, it requires so much of you. It requires so much of your time and your effort and your, you know, your thinking things through and planning things out and finishing a project of length. And it just takes a lot of effort. It's not the easiest way to go. No, it's not ditch digging. You know, it's not the worst job ever. It's not a physical job, really. But the writing part is a very kind of isolating job, and not everybody is willing to do that work. Even though it sounds pretty glamorous, but it's the actual work of it isn't very glamorous.
Well, every author that I've talked to has a different way of writing, different. Style, different discipline on how they write. Some will start up early in the morning and they'll write till noon or till 11 o'clock, and then they go to lunch, and then they go for a hike, and then they come back and they do the whatever they're going to do, and then eventually something comes out of that. But what is your discipline, or do you have one?
Well, John, I wish I had more discipline than I do. I have had discipline in the past, especially when I was working full-time still and I was writing, you know, on the side. Most people who have jobs don't have a lot of on-the-side time, but I had to figure out how to keep writing even when that wasn't my primary job. So I wrote during my lunch hours. I couldn't count on it every day. You know, anybody who has a job knows that lunch hours are sometimes a little rare to be able to take, but I just tried to focus on keeping that hour clear so that I could at least have that 1 hour a day where I wasn't commuting, I wasn't working. That hour belonged to me. And in doing that, and in setting aside that 1 hour, I was able to build a discipline so that when I opened up my laptop, the second I opened it up, I could start writing. Mm-hmm. And that is something that was really important to me, to get my first 2 books done. Now that I'm a full-time writer, I have all the time in the world, and so I have less discipline, if that makes any sense.
Oh, yeah.
I don't need as much discipline because I've got a lot of time, but, yeah, and it depends on what point of the process I'm in, how much discipline I need.
Yeah. All right, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Lori Rader Day, who is an author of various kinds of books, and we're going to be talking about the range of what she's written, but especially about a book that she's written that has a Michigan flavor to it, which is called Under a Dark Sky. And I think we're all going to be fascinated by what it is that gave her the inspiration on this. So, this is John Smetanka, run with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Lori Rader Day, who is the author of a book called Under a Dark Sky, which has a mysterious sound to it, and it is. It's a mystery. And we're going to be talking to her about how it came about and more about her writing experience, why she's doing this, and whatever. So, this is John Smetanka on With Respect. So, Lori, I've given the tease here now to Under a Dark Sky, but before we talk about that, I want to talk about what is it that you write? Do you write the same kind of books, i.e. the same genre, or do you dabble in different genres?
Well, I think I'm all one genre. I am a mystery writer. That's sort of the all-encompassing tag that we give to the kinds of stories that I write. But within that broad genre of mystery, there's actually quite a range of books. And so the ones I write, the sub-genre, if you want to use a marketing term, is psychological suspense. So these are stories that are, dark stories. They're maybe, written as realism. You would identify real characters who feel like real people in them. And they are often people who are, they're regular people like you and me, but they get caught up in something that's extraordinary, a crime, the aftermath of a crime, a criminal's intent. That's kind of what I'm into. I like the real people, not private investigators, not policemen, not people who deal with crime on their, on their beat as part of their jobs, but people who are doing something else. Who somehow come up against a darkness or, crimes.
It's interesting because a prior guest in my show, Gillian Flynn, who wrote a number of dark, dare I say, scary books, I asked her about, I read one of her books, and it scared the bejesus out of me. The characters in it were very strange but very real. And scared me. And I was in prosecution for 25 years. I've seen, talked to, and faced
which
real murders.
Which one did you read? Which one of Gillian's did you read?
What was the name of it? It was, dear me, I can't think of the right
name. Was it Dark Places?
Dark Places, yes. Yeah.
Dark Places is the book, yeah, that's the book I read when I was in my MFA program in creative writing. And I had never really encountered this kind of book. And I thought, whatever this is this crime fiction? Is this literary fiction? Whatever this story is, this is what I want to be doing.
Have you ever met Gillian Flynn?
I have. I don't know that I can say I'm friends with her exactly, but we are definitely on the, if I saw her in the street, I could say hello.
Well, it's interesting. When she, when I was talking to her, I got the overall, this impression, she is a really nice person. And I, at the end of the show, I was just overwhelmed by this, and I said, Gillian, how did you write these characters? Because they scared the bejesus out of me. And she said, at this point in your career, no one's asked me that, but when I was a little girl, I used to like to create stories, tell stories that scared me. And so she said, that's all I do now, is I scare myself. And so it was a fascinating way of describing it. I saw a Chicago Tribune interview of her piece, and the author started off by saying Gillian Flynn is a really nice person. Then the interview talked about how she planned on killing him at his request. And ends up the story.
You know, the thing is, people who write dark stories, they get it out on the page. So whatever frustrations they have, whatever you know, dark revenge fantasies they have about, you know, people they meet in their life, they get that out on the page. And then they're perfectly adjusted, normal people. Mystery people are fantastic friends. They are fun-loving, although they do, you know, if they gather up at these mystery conferences that we go to in the bar, always, you know, we talk about how to get away with murder. People who wander by don't stay very long. They hurry away. But, you know, we have a good time.
You know, that's interesting.
Most of them are really, really nice people.
You know, I found that you and I had a dinner down in Fort Lauderdale at the Broward County Lit Fest program, mm-hmm. and one of the things I was thinking about is that you were a really nice person, and we had a great conversation, and we talked about Michigan and whatnot, and I said, you've got to come on my show, and you said, great, let's do it. I've got a book review, or I've got a book tour, and let's do it after that. Well, at any rate, this verifies what you just said, that is, that mystery writers are nice people, eh?
They are, and they're very generous, too. I you know, when I first started getting published and realized that I was a mystery writer, which I had to be told, I started meeting mystery writers, and they were so generous to me. And I didn't have a contract. I didn't have a book finished, really, at the time. I didn't have an agent. But everyone was so welcoming, and they had advice for me. You know, they helped me get my place in the community. And it is a community. It's a, you know, group of friends. It's a big group of people, but we love to see each other, love to have opportunities to get together and just chat, be weirdos together.
Be successful. One person's success is not the other person's failure. One person's success is you're adding something to the mix.
The interesting thing is, in mystery writing especially, and maybe this is true of romance as well, the readers are so voracious. They love to find a new writer. They love to add to their to-be-read list. And it doesn't mean that someone buys my book and I'm new. It doesn't mean that they're not going to buy the next book of somebody who they've been reading for 10 years. They just add. They don't abandon very often. They just add. They love finding new books to read.
You know, I've never heard it described that way. I've gone through a number of mystery writers that I read everything that I could find of theirs, and then I moved on to somebody else, but I came back. Alan First, mm-hmm. Agatha Christie, the woman who wrote Lord Peter Wimsey mysteries.
Dorothy Sayers.
Dorothy Sayers, thank you. But you're right. You're absolutely. They're all write differently. There's a different style. Sherlock Holmes is different than mm-hmm. Lord Peter Wimsey's program, and so on. So, and
but
yours,
a lot of people, if they like one, they'll like the other. It you know, there's readers have a broad range of what they like as well. So,
well,
there's just a lot of room at the table when it comes to mystery writing.
My personal assistant in the office, in my law office, I had read your book and I gave it to her, and she's a mystery writer, pardon me, reader, and she loved it, but she loved it for different reasons, and which is very interesting to me, that we all take to a particular author, a particular book, a particular genre, because somehow it triggers pleasure in us. And resolve some itch that mm-hmm. we have, and so I'm fascinated by that with each different author I talk to, and how there's a certain degree of self-recognition that everybody has, and also a little puzzlement. Why is it that people like my writing? You know, there's just a little twitch of this. All right, so. A dark place in a dark Park are at the heart of your book, Under a Dark Sky. What are we talking about? And I don't know if everybody knows about dark parks.
Well, I always start there because you're right. Not enough people know about them, but I think you're going to hear more and more about them because they're expanding. So there is an organization called the International Dark Sky Association, and they have a program where they designate dark sky parks. They also designate dark sky places of various types, including towns who want to become dark sky communities. And all it means is that the place that's applying for this designation has done a little work. They've done a little work to see what kind of lighting they have, where it points, what does it illuminate, does it illuminate only what is necessary, and in the case of dark sky parks, do they have some programming to teach people about darkness and why it's important to have? Why it's important to have, just very briefly, is because light pollution is a problem for the Earth's wildlife. Not just, you know, when we think wildlife, we think the birds. Yes, it's a problem for the birds, for their migratory patterns. It's a problem for, you know, animals that are seeking food at night and can't find any dark places to find their prey. It's also a problem for the wildlife that we know as human beings. Some of the research we've seen lately about blue light, you know, your phone and your iPad or whatever, you're reading that until the second you turn off your lights to go to bed. It's not great for us to have that blue light, that white light shining in our face until the second we want to go to sleep. We may be having trouble sleeping in these instances. It's like that, only on a broader landscape. It's white light, blue light is bad for us as, you know, a whole. Whole cities that are too bright, like Chicago, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Where I live, it blots out all the night sky. And it's not just a visual thing. It's not just, oh, we can't see the stars and that's a bummer. It's that the light keeps us up. It makes us not healthy. It causes problems with, you know, wildlife in our area, which depletes, you know, their populations. It's about being able to see the sky and understanding that you are part of something bigger than what you can see here on Earth. You know, we wish upon the stars, but if you can't see the stars, you know, what is your childhood like?
Yeah.
Can you see past your own, you know, your existence to understand that you're part of something bigger? It's a lot of that. So the IDA has these designations to try to find patches of places where they have protected the night sky so that people can go and be a part of that and you know, take a breath and see some stars.
When I was a kid, we'd come over from Chicago to Michigan and lay on the beach at night and stare up at the stars. And I remember vividly that when it was a clear night, that is when there's no clouds, the stars almost were oppressive in a sense that they were just so powerful up there. The Milky Way I knew from my interest in astronomy that it was our galaxy, but it was just a white blanket.
Kind of like a mist, right?
Yeah, like a mist. And then you could see
a cloud of stars.
And the Pleiades, the seven sisters that mm-hmm. you had to test your eyesight, and like the and the Ursa Major, the Big Dipper that Native Americans used to test their children's eyesight. How many stars can they see at that in the tail of the Big Dipper, Ursa Major, or how many of the seven sisters can you actually honestly count? And so that, when I was growing up, was really great. And my dad would take us down to the beach, and we would have bonfires and hot dogs and hamburgers and marshmallows. And then, as the fire died down, we'd lay on the beach and look up at the stars and count the constellations and whatnot. It was great, powerful experiences. But can't do that anymore. Chicago's
light. It's hard to do in a lot of places. And can you imagine having a childhood just like yours, except that you didn't have that experience?
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be you know, you wouldn't have that fond memory and you wouldn't have that connection to astronomy quite as much as you do.
Well, you know, this, the interesting thing is if you are laying on a beach and you're looking up and you see clouds or you see mist or you see light pollution, you don't appreciate the fact that between you on that beach and a galaxy light years away is nothing but outer space and a very thin blanket of atmosphere around our planet. And it's just, there's no wall up there. You go right through it. You just walk, fly
up. It's not like a backdrop with little sparkles on it. It's everything.
That's right.
It's endlessness.
That's exactly right.
And people who don't have that access to the sky where they live, when they see the Milky Way, they think something's wrong.
Mm.
They don't understand what they're seeing. It's almost like, this can't be what I'm seeing. I don't understand what I'm seeing. And that's why it's so important to have these spots where you can go, where kids can have that experience, even if they can't have it in their backyard.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Lori Rader Day, who's the author of Under a Dark Sky. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about her novel, which blends all of the experiences we've been talking about. Living out in the country, small towns, Chicago, and all different kinds of people, and a dark sky. This is John Smetanka. Run with respect, and we'll be right back. Now back on With Respect with Lori Rader Day, who is an author of a book called Under a Dark Sky, a mystery and a psycho mystery. That is a psychological thriller. So, this is John Smetanka. So, Lori, when we broke, we had talked about the experience of seeing the stars, the bad part about light pollution. But there are places, as you said, that towns and places that tout their ability, a person's ability to see the stars and whatnot at night because there is no light pollution. How does that tie into your book and to Michigan?
Well, the dark sky parks that the International Dark Sky Association have designated, I mean, I owe them the entire novel because I heard about a dark sky park being designated, and I thought, well, that I've never heard of that. I don't know anything about that, but I'm drawn to it. And also, a place set aside for darkness, that sounds like a perfect place for a murder mystery. Now, I don't think that's what the IDA had in mind when they designated these places and they started this program. They were trying to protect places from light pollution for all of us to enjoy forever. But, my dark mind went to, how can I make a story out of this? And I thought, it's such a perfect place. Surely somebody else has done this already, surely. So I went looking, I researched to see if anybody had done it. And as far as I know, I was the first person to publish a book set in an IDA-designated dark sky park. And now some of these parks are obviously, they were parks before, so it's possible there are stories already written about these places, but not as a dark sky park designated. So that's where the story idea came from. I heard about one of the parks being designated, and I thought, well, that sounds fascinating. I'm going to look into that. I had an open contract with HarperCollins. I had a two-book deal. I had written and was publishing the first book, but of course at some point you have to decide, what is this untitled number four that I have a contract and a deadline for? And I had this idea sort of in my back pocket when we're also told to sort of, you know, write about the things that concern us, the things that worry us, the things that scare us as writers. One of those things is that my husband might die. My husband's mother died young, and so that's something that I think about. It is probably the scariest thing in my actual life. And so I decided that you know, I could write about somebody who has been put in that situation, a young widow, and she's going to go to this dark sky park. Now, I had to figure out, why does she go? What brings her there? And what is she dragging behind her, you know, as far as emotional baggage? But that's where the story started. So I owe the IDA and the dark sky parks a lot.
Did you have a particular place in mind that you drew on, your actual experience with a dark park?
So I'm not sure which one I heard about that actually started this story, but it might have been the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in Mackinac City, Michigan. It was about the right timing for when I originally had the idea. And then when I went to actually write the story, to research the story and see if I could make this story happen, the Headlands was the place I went to. Not literally, I didn't make it there for quite a time, but I went to their website and I researched that park because it was the closest one to Chicago at the time. Since then, I think they've designated a few more that might be a little closer, but the Headlands was the only dark sky park that I could get to in about 6 hours at the time. So that's the one I chose and researched, and it actually fed me the rest of the story. So I had, you know, this dark sky park situation, and I had a woman who was a new widow. I didn't know why at the time, and I hadn't started writing yet. I needed one more spot on the map before I could really start writing the story, and the Headlands gave me that point of the map. I went to their website, I researched, and I realized they have a guest house. Well, that sounds fantastic. I would love to stay in the guest house at the Dark Sky Park so I could research my story, but I couldn't figure out how much it cost because I couldn't decide if it was by the room, by the person, you know, if it was just a flat fee for however many people are inside the building. I still don't know, as a matter of fact. But that confusion was the last point on the map. I knew I can get some strangers in the same place at the same time because there's been a misunderstanding about how much of the house you get when you sign up to stay at the guest house. So the Headlands gave me the permission to really start writing the story. Then that's where I started.
You brought six fellow travelers, so to speak, into your story, and each one of them brought with them, dragged along, their baggage. And I never engage in spoilerism, but I think that a description of the kinds of people that appeared with your heroine might be interesting.
Sure. So Eden Wallace, you know, new widow. She is about 9 months out from being a widow. Decides that she finds the paperwork for a reservation to the guest house in a dark sky park in her husband's effects. It's around the same time as their 10th wedding anniversary, or would have been. So she thinks, I'm gonna keep this reservation. She's actually developed a fear of the dark. She's, you know, devastated by her husband's death for many reasons, many of which are spoilers, so I won't go into them. But, you know, she's very fragile. She's afraid of the dark. She leaves her lights on all night at home. But she's tired of being that person. By the time we meet her, she's ready to move on. So she keeps that reservation at the Dark Sky Park, even though it scares her to death. And she decides she's going to use that opportunity to just, you know, scream it out, get up there and just get through the night and get back into life so that she can get on with her existence. She has to. She's about to run out of money. She has to sell her house. You know, things are coming to a head and she needs to figure them out. So she goes thinking this romantic getaway that he's made possible for her, she's going to use it. But when she gets there, there are six other people either in the house or coming very shortly. They all know each other, give or take. There's a new girlfriend that one, you know, none of them have met except for the one who brings her. But the rest of them went to college together, and they've brought all those old feelings and frustrations with them, along with they're trying to figure out how to be friends in, you know, adult life, which is a tough subject. But there's also a lot of history that the reader learns from each of them, and they're all very different people. As you mentioned, they all have their own darknesses, their own secrets. I actually devised this group of people from thinking about all the ways, all the things people might do in the dark if they thought they could get away with it. What are some of the bad behaviors that people might, you know, they wouldn't do it in daylight. They wouldn't do it in front of people. They wouldn't want to be thought of as those kind of people. But what might they do if they thought they could get away with it? So there are lots of personalities showing up at the house. John, you're right.
It's a fascinating group of people, an absolutely fascinating group of people. Had you met these people before?
I hope not. no, but I, you know what I was thinking about? I was thinking about the internet and the ways that people will operate because they don't think of themselves as being themselves on the internet. They're shielded, they're anonymous. They'll say things to other people that they wouldn't say to their faces. It's that kind of behavior. They're not, from the outside anyway, they're not evil people, although, you know, one of them turns out to be, of course, it's a murder mystery. But I wanted to have a variety of people, not just for the suspects, red herrings, and that sort of thing that you need, but to show kind of the range of how people will act when they think they can get away with it. But I did have Agatha Christie, you mentioned her earlier, in mind in this case because I wanted in this book, for just personal reasons, I try to do something different with each book. I wanted an Agatha Christie level of suspects. I just wanted a lot of people, and I wanted that, you know, drawing room moment, although I don't know if I ever have the drawing room moment, you know, at the end where everyone could have done it, but only one person did.
When you're teasing out one of these plots, and this really required, as I went through it, it required a lot of thinking, as well as something that I was not accustomed to, which is getting inside people's emotions and emotional history, and having them work out their issues, their problems throughout the book. Internal to themselves. So, but I was fascinated by how you got the park, the building, and the town, as well as some townies, wrapped into this story. Did you go up there and sit around and talk to these folks and say, hey, I can imitate their dialogue, I can, what?
I did go up to the town and the park eventually. It took me a little while. I was doing most of my research from home, which is not ideal. That is not how I like to work. All my other books up until this moment, this is my fourth book, so my other three books were about places I had lived and places I had worked. And so it wasn't as difficult to, quote-unquote, research the character of the town or the characters you'll find in the town. In this case, I had to do some guesswork. And I one of the reasons why Eden, the main character, is from Chicago is so that I didn't have to have an insider's view of the area. You know, she's coming into the town, and so she can sort of notice what an outsider will notice, which it is really a crutch, if you want to be honest. It was me being like, I know I'm not going to get it quite right if I try to make her somebody who's from the town. So I will make her from Chicago, and then she can note the things that would be of note. And that gave me a little bit of relief because I was worried about getting it right. I did eventually get to go up to that area, and I'm so glad I did. I got to speak at the library on Mackinac Island at an invitation from the library, and I got to stay at the Grand Hotel, which was fantastic. Mm-hmm. But the best part about that trip was I could actually spend some time at the park at last in person. And the good news is once I arrived and looked around, it felt like I had been there before because I had done so much research online. And, you know, it just felt like, okay, yeah, I think I'm pretty close here. There were a couple things, though, that I would have got wrong if I hadn't taken that trip. And I will admit to them now, to all of Michigan. one of the things that I would have gotten wrong for sure is that when I first started writing this story, remember, I'm sort of feeling my way through this story. I don't plan the whole story out. I didn't know that Eden was going to be from Chicago at first. I just knew she's driving through Michigan, and she's going to go to Mackinac City and the park. And so I sort of had her, I had her going through Lansing to get there. Now, then I changed her to Chicago. You know, she's coming from Chicago. And then when I and my husband were driving from Chicago to Mackinac City, I realized, oh, this is wrong. She's not going to go through past Lansing. She's going to go past Grand Rapids.
Right.
I told that story to a library event, about 400 people in Grand Rapids. And at that moment, when I said the word Lansing, the entire group, all 400 people went, oh. I said, no, I fixed it, I swear. It was just an artifact of, you know, the early drafts that I figured out as I was driving up there. The other thing I would have gotten wrong if I hadn't made that trip is I didn't realize how far out you can see the Mighty Mack Bridge.
Mm.
You know, it's about 8-10 miles out from the town. Mm-hmm. You can see the bridge, and I didn't know that, so I didn't have her, Eden, in the book have an experience of seeing the bridge until she's on it much later in the book, and so I made sure, you know, I fixed that. But yeah, these are the things that if you don't make the trip, will trip you up.
That's right.
And I didn't want to get letters. So far, no letters. No letters from people from Michigan saying I got it wrong.
All right. We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Lori Rader Day, who is an author. She has written several books. We'll get to the other titles in a minute. But we've been talking about her experience writing and researching for a book, Under a Dark Sky, talking about a murder which occurred in a dark sky park. And we're going to, that's about as far as I can go without starting to tease out spoilers. So this is John Smetanker on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Lori Rader Day, the author of Under a Dark Sky. And we've been talking about how the book was written, who the characters are, what it's all about in terms of is it Dorothy Sayers, is it
Agatha Christie?
Agatha Christie, whoever. And this is John Smetanker. So, when we got when we broke, we were talking about you coming to Mackinac City and finding out what the people were like, somewhat, but also about Mackinac Island and about the bridge. What did you take from that and your trip up there? Had you been to Michigan much?
I've been to Michigan quite a few times in my lifetime, but as an adult, not as much, and so it was nice to just go through the entire state. You know, if you start in Chicago and go to Mackinac City, you're seeing quite a bit of Michigan, quite a bit of the Mitten State. So that was a good time. My husband and I actually drove from Michigan up to Mackinac City and then went over the bridge and then all the way around Lake Michigan. So we didn't do the exact circle tour. You know, it's an exact highway, but we did do the entire loop around Lake Michigan, which was really fun. But I didn't know Michigan as well as I would like, and that's why I definitely did a lot of research. I have some friends who grew up in Michigan, and so I talked to both of them about, you know, what did Michigan mean to them, and it wasn't my main character who needed to feel that way, but the townies that you mm-hmm. referenced. I laughed because the townies are my favorite characters. One of the characters is a police officer who seems to have led a little bit of a sheltered life, and she won't, you know, she won't swear. And I don't know where she came from, but I really just ended up really having a crush on that character. She was so fun to write.
Yes, she was. I liked her very much, and I've seen her I've seen her around Michigan.
Have you?
Oh, yeah. I told an author one time that he was from Michigan, actually wrote his book out in Oregon, but it was about riding on trains and met all kinds of weird people. And I said, you know, your book, the characters, I got to tell you, I prosecute every one of them. And he said, what? I said, every person, they're all malign people. They're just awful, horrible human beings. Hardly, deserving of the title human being. Mm. And I said, so every one of them, for different reasons, I prosecuted. And he sent an email back to me later telling about how pleased he was because he told his friends back in Oregon that I had said they're all realistic because they are evil people. He says, I got it right. But anyway,
when I write my characters, you know, one of them is evil, and actually most of them have very bad qualities, if not evil ones. But I end up liking them all, and it's sort of hard to assign, you know, who is the person, because it can be anybody. You know, I put six or seven people in that book, many of them all in the same room at the same time, by the way, not a easy challenge for a writer,
mm-hmm.
Or for the audio book narrator, as I hear.
Mm-hmm.
I end up liking them all. And so it makes it, I think, a better book if the reader likes them too and can see that they're all human. You know, the villain in any book should be a real person, and they do things because that's the way they see the world, not because they're evil. Necessarily.
You know, I did 25 years of prosecution, now 25 years of civil and criminal defense cases. And in all that time, I think I've run across two people who are what I would say truly evil. And the rest had bad breaks in life, or they were physically or psychologically scarred, or had no opportunities, or they had too many opportunities, and so on and so on. But mm-hmm. But as far as truly evil, you just can't say that there are that many of them out there. And as I say, in 50 years of work, I've only met two. So
yeah.
One of the other things I was fascinated by is how different people pick up different things about your book. So, for example, I'm an elderly male, and I looked at the plot twists and the description of the community and the description of the clues that you gave and whatnot, and the emotional part was not really something that I got into as much. But my assistant loved the way that your Eden worked out her own problems during the course of the adventure, and loved the style. I said, "Okay, Joanne, would you read another one of her books?" And she said, "Absolutely, I love them."
Yay! You made me a fan, John.
Yeah, I did, and I was. I'm always interested to see how different people react to the same stimulus, whether it's science or fiction or it's history or whatever I talk to people about. Everybody will take the same set of stimuli, the same subject matter, the same people, and look at it slightly differently. And I found that, mm-hmm. I always find that interesting. So,
well, that's the... before I get to your question, I'm sure you have a question you're going toward, and I don't want to stop you, but that's what writing fiction is about. You know, you're trying to figure out how to tell a story, but the same, if you have more than one character, the story is different to each of them. And so that's an exercise in point of view. In Under a Dark Sky, it's just one character basically telling her point of view, but every character in that story has a different take on what's happening and what they're seeing and what they're paying attention to. So get to your question, but that's exactly what the enterprise of writing a novel is all about, especially if you have a lot of different characters with different backgrounds.
You've just flowed into what my question was going to be.
And that,
and that is, I remember one conversation, there were many conversations between the parties, okay, between the various characters, but one in particular was with a woman in a bar, and I thought, that opened up a whole different viewpoint for that, for me, for that person. And I thought, because you have, until that time, she was a figure, period. She was there. She was moved around, did stuff. But then when you when you had Eden talking to this woman in the bar about her problems, about her life, and I thought that was fascinating.
Thank you.
I mean, became a character.
That's me getting to know the characters, right? Because, again, I'm not, I don't plot my novels all that much. And so I have these, they sort of start out as, okay, this person's going to have this characteristic, right? Again, I'm trying to find all the ways that people might try to get away with something, or they might, you know, do bad things in the darkness. But until I have them talking and showing who they are, I don't know who they are. So they're teaching me who they are as well as the reader.
So what are you going to do again? Well, what's your next book about? Are you now retired on your laurels?
No, I am not resting on any laurels. I will have another book out, I believe, February 2020, which sounds so far away, but it's not. It's right now, it's called The Lucky Ones, The Lucky One. I'm not sure if titles sometimes get nixed by the marketing department, but right now The Lucky One will be out from HarperCollins in February 2020. It is about a woman who was kidnapped as a child. She remembers everything. She was gone less than a day. Her policeman father was able to track her down and bring her home safely. All is well, except, you know, 30 years later, she feels like she got away. She's the lucky one. So she volunteers with a website that tries to match long, like, cold case missing persons with unidentified remains. There are real sites like this where people, just like you and me, are actual amateur sleuths, and they're trying to find closure for these families. She is working on the site one day when she recognizes a face, and it is the face of her kidnapper, who was never brought to justice, who never was identified. So she decides to undertake that as a little bit of a challenge to figure out what is this guy's story and maybe bring him to justice at last, as a favor to her father. So that is The Lucky One, and then I'm working on a book right now that is set in 1942 England, and that would be out in 2021. I am not resting on any laurels at all, John. these are tough projects that I've given myself.
Whereabouts?
But that's what I like to do.
Whereabouts in England?
In Devon. Set at the estate of one Agatha Christie, as a matter of fact. It's based on a true story in World War II when children were being evacuated out of London because of the bombs. 10 children were placed at Agatha Christie's house in Devon. This is based on, in fact, and it's never been written about as far as I can tell.
Good for you. Well, we've talked about your books and we've talked about you. I hope that our listeners appreciate how hard it is but yet how much fun it is for you to put yourself into the position of so many different characters and to work their problems out at the same time as you're telling a good tale. So I enjoyed the book. And I hope that my listeners will give it take a look. And so, thank you very much, Laurie. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But thanks.
Well, thank you very much, John.
Good. The name of our program is With Respect. And remember, our motto, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.